Thanks for listening to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all the socials, as well as your favorite podcast catchers. If you haven't subscribed yet, now's the perfect time. I promise I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey everyone, I am hoping that this podcast are helping you through the long days of social distancing. As we begin another week, I wish safety and health to all of you. Today's podcast is another virtual tasting trip. This one took me to, although I've never been, one of my favorite places on earth. I can close my eyes and take a sip of wine from this region, and I can see myself walking on a stunning sand beach, or imagine myself in the center of the most beautifully green land that I have ever seen. There are women diving for crustaceans, and of course, there is wine. Although the region does produce some lovely red wines, they are known for their whites. Their reputation for salinity and acidity in their wines make wine lovers crave them. And today, a group of wine lovers got together over Zoom and enjoyed a glass of Albarino together while learning about the magnificent wine region known as Rias Baixas. Thank you, Gregory and Vine, for arranging this happy hour, and thanks to the wonderful wine educators Rick Fisher and Kat Thomas for leading the journey. Sláinte.
I'm Stephanie. For those of you that only know me by email, I'm Stephanie Gutierrez. I work with Gregory and Vine representing Rias Baixas. And today we are doing our Albarino tasting. See, I got my t-shirt on.
Yay!
Okay, I'm just going to wait 1 minute to make sure that everyone's joined and has their audio set up.
Hey. Oh, nice. Very nice, Trish. Very nice.
Hi, Jeff. Long time no see.
Deb! And I turned the light on. It's blinding me, but that's okay.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, hey, Lori.
I got polka dot bottle with polka dot glasses.
There we go. That's cool.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
And I have a new to me one.
Ooh.
That's
a
nice one.
Yay!
So I think we're good to start.
Okay.
So just a quick intro. So this is Rick Fisher.
Hey, Rick.
Say hi, Rick.
He's a Spanish.
Hi, Rick.
As a matter of fact, I do.
So he's a Spanish wine scholar, education director with Wine Scholar Guild. And then we have Kat Thomas. Hi, Kat.
Hi.
The wine training manager with Hawkinson Group.
With my disco ball.
So you guys are probably wondering what this first picture is. And these two pictures are very representative of mine and Kat's friendship. So if you look in the background behind our pose, we're modeling the statue that is sitting behind us. And this is at which bodega was that, Trish?
It was Pato Bayon.
Pato Bayon, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And then the one on the right is when we were out. We did a boat trip out in outside of Rias Baixas, and so it was fun. It was a lot of fun. So I'll do another quick introduction. So as Stephanie said, my name is Rick Fisher. I work with the Wine Scholar Guild. I am the creator and the education director for the Spanish Wine Scholar Program. And so I'm going to pass it off to Kat to do another quick intro for her. And then we're going to take you guys through about a 3-hour presentation. And then, okay, good. At least I got people's attention.
Wait, hold on. I don't have enough wine for 3 hours.
That's because you have to be double fisting it.
Yeah.
I got to go back to the fridge. Hold on.
No, we've got a short presentation that we want to take you guys through. For those of you who aren't familiar with the region or want a little refresher, we're going to talk about some stuff there. And then we're going to share some tastings and, you know, kind of go round robin with that. So, Kat, I'll let you introduce yourself, and then I'll go ahead and take the presentation from there.
Awesome. Thank you all for being here today. For anybody that has not met me before, I'm super quiet, very reserved. And for anybody that does know me, boldface lie. I work for Hakkasan Group. I'm actually very fortunate to be on furlough. I consider that fortunate still. Even more fortunate to be invited to be with you all today, to be manhandling, womanhandling, however, handling two bottles of really badass Albarino. I really love the region. I love Albarino. I love the way that it can express itself just like humans can. I do wine training and buying for the United States when we are functioning and up and running, and I get to travel around the planet and kind of talk about different areas of the world today, hopefully learning from all of you about what's inside your glass as well. So
cool. Thanks, Kat. Hey, I saw a post on Facebook this morning. Some of you may have seen it, and it basically said, if you have two wine glasses and you can't touch your face.
Yeah, I saw that.
I thought that was very appropriate for our current situation. All right, so let's take a little trip. This, as you all know, is Spain. This is actually one of the maps from our Spanish Wine Scholar program. And you can see, let me see if I get the mouse here. Oops, not yet. So for those of you who aren't as familiar, so Spain here, we've got up here in the northwestern corner in Galicia, you've got five main DO wine regions here. Rías Baixas here is actually Spain's westernmost wine region. And we'll talk a little bit more about this, but you can see, you know, you've got the influence from the Atlantic over here. You've also got the Bay of Biscay in the north. And these top four regions here along the northern part of Spain are referred to as Green Spain. And a lot of that has to do, I mean, predominantly with the fact that there's so much rainfall up in this area. And as you go through, it is just, it's mountainous and it's beautiful and it's green and it's lush and it's absolutely incredible. And then you've also got along here, you've got a mountain range called the Cordillera Cantábrica, which also does help influence a lot of the regions here. Not so much Rías Baixas because it doesn't extend that far out. You do have a little a mountain range over here called the Galician Massif. But for the most part, that main mountain range affects much of Green Spain and Castile and León. All right, a little bit deeper look here at Galicia. So as I said, there are five wine regions in Galicia. You can see them all listed here. You've got Rías Baixas along the coast, Monterrey in the south, Ribera Sacra, which is a fairly massive region here in, of course, the eastern part of Galicia, Ribeiro, which neighbors Rías Baixas, and then you've got Valdeorras over here. And for the most part, you know, you're looking at heavily maritime climates over here on this side. And then as you move closer to Castilla y León, you do get more continental influences, a little bit less rainfall, a little bit more continental influence. And grape-wise, these three regions here tend to focus heavily on Mencia and Bodeo, but they do use a lot of indigenous grapes outside of that as well. And when you're over here on the side, on the western side, you've got Ribeiro, which does use actually a fair amount of Albarino, but their main grape is Trechadura. Most of their stuff is blends. And then you've got our big daddy here of Galicia, Spicious with Albarino. They are the big daddy, Steph, or big mommy, whatever you want to call them. All right, so just a couple of notes here about the region. As we said, it's located in Green Spain. And you could see as we were looking at the map here, these little nooks and crannies as they go through, they're called Rías, R-I-A-S, which obviously is where the region gets its name from. And they're basically like these submerged river valleys that are nestled throughout the coast. Maritime climate with fairly high amounts of rainfall some region closer to the coast can reach upwards of, you know, 60 plus inches of rain a year. Predominantly granitic soils in this region, and it's fascinating. I think we might have a picture in here, but for those of you who have seen pictures of the region and have been there, you look at these pergolas that they grow the grapes on. It is amazing that they're using these granite pillars to hold these things up. You know, people here pay, you know, top dollar to put it on a countertop, and they're just, you know, they've got them stuck in the ground to hold up grapes. Vineyards here planted from the coast around 330 feet up towards close to 1,000 feet. And the DO is a fairly young DO. I mean, it's just a little over 30 years old. And originally when they were created the DO, which was back in 1980, they actually were, let me see, I've got it, the La Denominación Específica Albariño was the name of the region. And because the EU in 86, when they joined the EU, Spain joined the EU, 88, they went to change to become an official wine region. They couldn't have the name of a region, the name of a grape be the name of the region. Now, there is one exception for that in Spain, and that is Carignana. And I suspect that that is probably because it was an established wine region well before the EU, the entrance into the EU. All right, five subzones here in Rias Baixas, and we're just going to kind of work from north to south. You can see the top here, Ribera de Ulla. This is the smallest region. It's one of the smallest regions. It's by far the newest, and there are some really nice red wines that are produced in this subzone. Then you've got the Val do Salnés. This is along the coast here, and you can see, and even given the size of it compared to some of the others, you see it's fairly comparable to Condado de Otea and a little bit bigger than Orosal, but this is massive production here. More than 60% of the production in the DO comes from this one subzone. It is the oldest subzone, and it's also the home of Albariño. As you move further south here, you've got the smallest subzone, Sotomayor, this particular subzone is the only subzone within Rias Baixas that only produces wines from Albariño. They do not blend with any other grape, even though it's allowed, and the vast majority of production coming out of there is 100% anyways, but Sotomayor does not use any other grapes. Then you move a little further south along the inland coast here. You've got Condado de Otea. This is the second largest subzone behind Val do Salnés, and it is also the most continental. So it's warmer and drier. And I think, Kat, you have a wine from Condado de Otea today, right? Yeah. And then finally, you move along the Portuguese border towards the Atlantic to Orosal. And this actually covers about 14% of the production. Condado de Otea has about 20% of the production. So you can see from Val do Salnés, Condado de Otea, and Orosal, you've got these massive, the vast majority of the production in the region. And Kat, it is off to you.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't start any of my seminars off with a toast. So to all of you beautiful humans here.
Cheers.
And my toast to you all. Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right. Woo! Love the acid on that one. All right. So there are a lot of fun sounding grapes that you'll find in such a small, beautiful, compact little region. I kind of think about myself because I'm called the tiny giant by some really fabulous humans. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, but with all of that being said, 99% of all the wine in Rias Baixas is actually white, and most of that, actually 97% of that, is from the Albariño grape. Other permitted white varieties being Trechadora, Loureiro, Caño Blanco, Torrontés, not to be mistaken with the other Torrontés, Alexandria, which is found over in Chile and Argentina, and Godello. And then our red varieties are Caña Tinto, Espadero, Loureira Tinta, Suzón, Mentilla, Pedral, and
Bronkeyal, and I'm sure that you'll hear them pronounced a few different ways, especially if you jump over the Minho River into Portugal. They are pronounced slightly different, but they are very similar, if not the same grapes. They might taste a little different or made in a different style there. Now, there's a few things that might be a little contradictory in rules and such. Now, especially this is kind of fun with one of the wines that I picked today, and I did this for a few different reasons on purpose, but I'll get to that during the tastings. So the rules state that all wines labeled Rias Baixas, so the whole region of Rias Baixas in Galicia, if it states that on the label, they have to be at least 70% Albariño, and the rest of it can be made up of that Caña Blanco, Treixador, Durantes, Loureiro, and the Godello. So I have a wine here that in 2018 supposedly had 60% of Albariño and the rest 40% of Treixadora. I'm not going to yell at anybody. I'm not going to tell on anybody because it tastes delicious. So we're just going to kind of go with that. Maybe Rick can kind of chime in a little later when we talk about that. But that's the rule that they kind of state. What we'll see mainly, of course, is Albariño in the area. Treixadora, we're going to find in that subzone of Condado de Teia. And Condado de Teia is found inland. It's a little warmer in that area. Treixadora is really cultivated and added into that very kind of zingy, acidic, lean Albariño to kind of add some flesh, some lemony, kind of creamy zest to it. Where if you're, say, in the O Rosal, which is really on the coast, kind of high terraced areas, that's going to also kind of embrace and kind of make itself a nice little hug around the Albariño with the Loureiro. Godello is often confused, I'll say, maybe in a blind taste for people getting into this area. Mimics a little bit of a Chablisian style. And Caña Blanco can definitely mimic a little bit of the Albariño itself. Rick mentioned that there is some fabulous and amazing red wines coming out of the area. Being that we were able to taste some of them because we were there, I can agree to that and attest to it. We do not get to see many or if any of these red grapes coming into the States. So if you do have a chance, snatch them up. It doesn't matter if you fall in love with them or not. It's the chance to taste a grape that has a 1% chance of even making it into the bottle, right? So it's a really fun experience. Menthia is probably the one grape that makes a name for itself, but you'll find that actually going more east and going outside of the Rias Baixas area.
Hey, Kat, let me ask a quick question. You know, as Kat was talking about the grapes, I'm curious, how many of you guys have ever had a red from Rias Baixas?
I had a couple times.
Okay, cool. What'd you think?
Loved it. I mean, acid up the wazoo, which is my thing. So.
Exactly. I think they're fascinating. And, you know, I love that this region, you know, does Albariño so well. But it's these little hidden treasures when you start looking around and when you find them. Like Kat said, snatch them up because they are bound to be fascinating, a fascinating and interesting experience when you're tasting. So I was just curious.
Kat, I'll use that verbiage next year at Tiwa. Yeah.
I'm going to trademark it first.
Yes. and another, I mean, a kind of interesting thing that I love, and it's definitely indicative of the soil structure and the grapes themselves, but the alcohol levels are always so low. I mean, it's hard to get the alcohol levels high here anyway with the climate and such and the grapes, but just the starting alcohol for an Albariño here is like 11.3%. And that's kind of, and red wines at 10%, to get their wines at 10% is like a chore and a challenge, which of course, most of us on here probably are like, woohoo. So I just think that's kind of a fun little thing too. So sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Kat. It's all up. Cheers.
Oh yeah, this is me too. Sorry. Okay, let me just go to the next. So viticultural practices. Yes.
if you've never seen a spectacle as such, it is awe-inspiring. Now, I am a tiny giant, meaning I am under 5 foot. I'm not going to give you the exact measurements, but I can stand well under these pergolas. So these beautiful granite posts are holding up all of these other granite posts that have these trellised, beautiful canopies of vines just covering them and giving shade and offering this wonderful, beautiful hat that cover the grounds. And I can stand there and kind of look up and be mesmerized and be covered. Now, I have to stand on things and reach up in order to do any harvesting, where some taller humans can just reach up and snip, snip, snip. But what this does, there's a few different purposes for this. It allows shading, natural shading from that beating sun when that happens. It allows a function for other agriculture to actually grow underneath. So in the midst of growing things on top, like a rooftop garden, you actually are able to utilize all of that beautiful earth and space underneath as well to grow different agriculture. So multi-purpose in that sense. And since we are coastal climate, for the most part, you've got a lot of humidity. So if you're ever kind of in a desert situation, which being in Las Vegas, I typically am, I go to, say, somewhere like Texas, and my hair goes ding because of all the humidity. I like to stay cool, wear loose clothing, kind of let the air flow through me. And this is exactly what these grapes and vines need to have happen. So a pergola sort of formation allows a lot more wind flow and a lot more of that sunshine to flow through at an even balanced pace, allowing a natural kind of sunshine and sort of sun lotion sort of effect to come through. Now that's great when you have a flat and sort of low hilly area. That's where you'd find that, say, in the Valdesanas, in some parts of the Sotomayor. But where you've got more of those steep sort of areas, particularly we'll look at the Oversal, some inland parts of the Condado de Otea, and definitely in the Ribera de Ulla, where the Romans created all of these stepped up sort of arched areas where they created these vines and natural pathways. It's really hard to have these granite sort of pergolas, so they created the trellising of the VSP, so vertical shoot positioning. As non-traditional as this may seem, this is now a newer way and a definite easier way, but it's a more sustainable way for these vines on these terraced and hillier slopes to manage and to make the best use of not only erosion and terrain, but the force of the sun and the slope and the action that they're on. Winemaking techniques and trends. So I've had the fun and fortune of being on a few of the seminars with Gregory and Vine and tasting some older of the Albarinos. And I'm fascinated every time I taste them. And Rick and I actually got to try something that was well over 10 years old. And it was delicious. I don't want to kind of name any names if we're not supposed to. I'm not sure how we're supposed to do that. But we tasted something that was outstanding. It was 03, correct?
Yeah, it was an 03. You can name the name. It's they're a big producer in the region. Paso de San Llorens.
I wasn't sure if I was supposed to shout out or wait or, you know. But Paso de San Llorens, like, just badass. Like, it was amazing. And how badass that was is doing what a lot of winemakers do when they want something to kind of develop, become a little more rich and textured, and preserve themselves by batonnage or lee stirring. So I have a wine also today that I picked that has a bit of age on it that went through 3 years of aging on the lees.
And winemakers now, again, non-traditional for this specific style of winemaking that has been ages and ages. Now, maybe they did this when they first started making wine without knowing it. But for the most part, Albarino has been known to be this fresh, zingy, zesty, fun, crisp, drink it right out when it's made kind of wine. And now people are starting to experiment and let their wine sit on the lees, maybe stir it, maybe just let it sit on lees, maybe kind of play around with a little bit of oak fermentation, maybe let it sit with some malolactic fermentation. And they're finding that there is such a difference. Is it going to be that they're trying to make it like a Chablis? No, maybe somebody is. Maybe somebody out there, the one producer, I mean, there's not many people out of the total 500 and some that are making wine there. But for the most part, I think it's just adding to the style of Albarino. And that's my little humblest opinion. It's just creating a new kind of fun differentiation of what Albarino is and creating a different complexity of that grape. And then, what the heck does Albarino taste like?
And now, a word from our sponsor. Did you know that Dracena Wines now has a wine club? We named it the Chalk Club. Draco is on our label, but Vegas was getting a little jealous, so we decided he deserved to be our club spokesdog. In Las Vegas, betting chalk means that you are betting on all of the favorites. We are betting that we are one of your favorite wineries, so we thought the name was apropos. The club is simple, yet a bit different than most. When you wager on us, we will ship you 3 bottles of wine twice a year, once in April and once in September. You can choose all red or mix of red and rosé. You immediately receive 15% off of all your wine purchases throughout the year, but what makes our club stand out is the progressive discount. Let your club membership ride into the next year. Your discount increases. Each year you parlay your membership, you receive an additional 5% off up to a planned maximum of 25%. Your club shipments are discounted to a flat $15, plus we'll cover your club shipping cost for your second shipment. That's $15 house money in a sure bet for you. So please head to our website, DracenaWines.com, and find out all of the benefits of joining the Chalk Club and how to sign up. We've stacked the odds so that you can get our award-winning wines without breaking the bank.
So these are just a few of the different profiles that come to mind. I actually like to add in. So when I'm going through this, especially with, for me, studying with, say, the Quartermaster Sommeliers or WSET, I come up with a lot of different other things that kind of come to mind. Salinity is a big marker for me. Whenever I taste salinity, of course, that immediately I come to Albarino, I come to Chardonnay from France and Chablis, and then I kind of start honing in on different structural things. But salinity is a big thing. Stone fruits, like you see the nectarine, sometimes peach and apricot. Citrus notes come through. Definitely florals, some orange and tangerines, some herbal notes come through. And really whatever I think in that vintage as well. I mean, in 2017, it was a short, crazy, frantic vintage, right? And it ended a little bit warm. So there's maybe a little more of those riper, tangerine-y kind of fruit notes, where in 16, it was a little less of that. You might get more zingy, grapefruity, kind of citrus, stone fruit, less ripe notes, and maybe a little more herbal kind of composition. But structurally standardized, I think there's great acidity. That's always something that I get with Albarino. I get a lot of honeysuckle, citrus, those stone fruits, moderate alcohol. And again, for me, salinity kind of brings all of that through to the back palate.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Kat. now you can drink. Now you can quench your palate. So we're going to jump into tasting here in just a minute. We definitely want to hear from you guys, but just a couple of last minute little things here. So just a couple of fun facts, I think, about the region, and really fascinating. More than half of the winemakers in this region are women. In fact, it was a woman who started the DO, and she was the president for 20 years. So, I'm always fascinated when, I'm seeing, and maybe it's because we're a little bit more attentive to that nowadays, but it's fun for me to taste wines that are made by women and then taste wines that are made by men, because I definitely get a difference in style. I tend to feel there's more elegance in a lot of these ways. So, Santiago de Compostela, for those of you who have been to Galicia, is the capital of Galicia. It is the last step on the Camino de Santiago. It is absolutely a spectacular place to visit. And if you get anywhere near Galicia, you have to visit there. So Galicia is really renowned for its seafood. And, we talk a lot about white wine and seafood, and there are very few wines that are a better pairing with seafood than Albariño. The freshness, the acidity, the saline notes that Kat was just talking about that always tend to carry through on the finish are just absolutely perfect. And so what I included in this presentation, and hopefully it'll work, you can see on the right of your screen, you see this picture here of, let's see if it works now. So these women called mariscadores, what they do is they go out, I think it's almost every single day, and they go out and they dig for seafood, for clams, for razor clams. And then they fill up their buckets and they go, and we got to see this. They go to this little auction place where they weigh everything and they get paid by the container. And it's absolutely fascinating. So we have the canned seafood in Galicia is really truly some of the best in the world. And so if you ever are in a place and you can find some, I highly recommend picking some up, because it's, again, perfect with these wines. All right, so we are going to do little round robin tasting here. This actually was a little stop that we did at a tiny little indiscreet producer called Martin Kodaks. And this is actually a sparkling Albariño. And for those of you who have not had one, if you find one, I will say they are very rare in the U.S. They are fun. The company that you're drinking it with is a big part of that. And the scenery that we were sitting at top of the winery, again, with another female winemaker, is awesome. So Kat and I actually each have two wines today. And we're just going to go through real quick and share with you guys what we're drinking. And I suspect that a number of you are probably drinking the same ones that Kat and I are. So we're going to alternate. I'm going to let Kat start, and then we'll pop through. And then I'm going to kill the presentation, because I can only see like six of you on the screen, and I want to see everybody. So I'm going to kill the presentation as soon as we get done with this slide here. And then it'll open it up, and we'll let you guys jabber on about how amazing your wines are, okay? Kat, go ahead.
Okay. So my first wine, as you can see on the screen, but I'll hold it up because it's fun, is 2017. So this is from Paso Pondal, the Minha Vida. So 2017, as I was saying, in Rias Baixas, really low yields that year. So, they don't have a lot of high yields as it is, so low yielding, but really great quality. And Condado do Teia, again, more inland, so it's a lot warmer of an area as it is. And where this has a blend of Albariño and the Trechadora. So where Trechadora is going to bring a little more richness, a lot more of that lemony kind of juiciness and texture. I always get a little more smokiness and almost, It's kind of like this herbal, kind of foresty kind of quality. And maybe it's because my head takes me back to climbing through the pines and the forest trees while we were there, which is amazing. I mean, you go from one sort of coastal area and then you're walking through a forest. It's beautiful. It's amazing. It's awesome. But what, again, this sort of culminates into is Abarino. So you've got this acid structure that starts to draw the palate and all these flavors back. And then you have this wonderful Trecciadora that all of a sudden starts to sort of envelope and wrap the tongue. And you've got that sort of lemon cream that sort of traps everything and draws it back all the way through on the tongue. So in addition now to salinity, to your citrus, and I get a little, of course, now riper stone fruits as opposed to more tart that I would get from, say, the Valdesanas or Oversal. I get more of that yellow peach and nectarine. I get that kind of like enveloping the tongue as opposed to just searing straight back through the palate. And it's really juicy. It still lingers, and it still makes the mouth water for more.
Cool. Thanks, Kat. All right, so I am drinking. My first wine is the Gran Bazan Etiqueta Ambar. And all right, way to go, Court. And this is a 2018. So 2018 was a pretty warm, it was a pretty dry year for Enria Spices. But this is 100% Albarino from the Salinas Valley. And again, these are both of the wines that I got to try today. Both are the bodega's oldest vineyards, and this one in particular, they are grown on pergola in the pergola vine training method in granite, and they do use organic treatment for all of their wines and all their vines as well. In this particular wine, they destem and then gravity fed to get the free run, and it sat in stainless steel tanks for about 5 months. And so this particular, this is a really great, fresh example of Albarino. It's very aromatic. It does have those stone fruit notes that Kat was talking about. It's like, it's got some like white peach, some flowers, and then really kind of racy acidity, which I personally love. And especially at 2:30 in the afternoon in San Diego. But again, it's never too early for a glass of Albarino, right, Steph? and so it just has a really nice long finish. It's got some nice citrus notes on the palate. And it does have a lot of those saline as you finish off. So we got the chance to visit this particular producer, and the winemaker is a nut. He was a lot of fun to hang out with. So, Kat, off to you for Fefiñanas.
All right. So Fefiñanas, another iconic producer and, delicious. I went with the 2014 because Rick took the 2012, but, I'm really, really excited that I got this one because it is amazing. It's delicious. This is labeled by Rias Baixas, and it is 100% Albarino. This is done in stainless, but I do think that I had a few conflicting stories here and there. So I'm wondering, since it is aged on leaves for 3 years, hence the El Año, it's Tres Años. It's aged on leaves for 3 years before they release that. I'm wondering if they have that in any time in used barrel. But it is in stainless steel for fermentation purposes. And it's quite fabulous. Now, 2014 was really rainy in the area, and this led to a lot of botrytis. Now, we don't really talk about botrytis in a lot of areas other than, you know, of course, our dessert wine areas. But botrytis doesn't necessarily have to be the downfall of things. It can add some enhanced flavors if the rot doesn't ruin the grapes. I'm not really seeing botrytis on these. I just wanted to add in that that was kind of a comment that I found in a lot of the articles about the vintage. I tried it in a few different glass styles, and I decided to go with more of a burgundy style. I started with, of course, the all-purpose white wine, and when I put it into the burgundy, I went back and forth a few times, and I just noticed that the fruit really just popped out after I put it back into the burgundy and came back. But this is where that lees texture, if you guys can get your hands on just a slightly older, you don't even need to go back to a 14. I mean, that's 6 years of age. I almost just said three. My goodness, we're in 2020. But if you can get your hands on something just slightly older, just to see if it's got some lees aging on it, just where this can go. I mean, you see a Muscadet that has all that acidity. That's more of a even neutral grape, and what that can do to that grape with food, and how you can drink that with things. Imagine what your grape, the Albarino, can do, and I'll kind of shut my mouth and leave it at that.
Hey, Kat, Jeffrey wanted to know if it does have like those yeasty, biscuity kind of aromas and textures because of the 3 years of lees aging.
Not at this point for this wine, and I figured once we got to yours, because every wine that I've tried for the Paco at that vintage has already started maturing into that. This has, it's kind of like at that, and I shouldn't use this analogy in this state of being that we're in, but it's at that top of the curve, and it seems like it's about to drop down and start maturing into that, but it's definitely getting there. It seems like it's about to start maturing to the next level. And it's not at a point where it's lost any of its vivacious sort of acidity. It hasn't lost any of that fruit connection, but it's definitely still, it's got some texture and body to it, but it's not like, it's not mealy or anything on the palate, but it's not at that level yet where I've tasted in the Paco y Lola yet.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Jeffrey, just to kind of follow up with that, because I have the 12 Paco y Lola, but it has a lot less lees aging than the Fefeñanes does. I think that one of the things that we noticed when we tried the Paso de Señorones, their Selección, the one that has a minimum 30 months of lees aging on it, the one that we had, the 3 over there, and I've had the 9 and the 10, Albarino responds really well to lees aging, and it doesn't take on those heavy, heavy, yeasty, bready notes like Chardonnay does. And so that's one of the things that I really like about this, is that these wines, even with lees aging, tend to keep their freshness and their acidity. They don't get real weighty and heavy on the palate. So to that, I'm drinking, my second wine is a 2012 Paco y Lola Vintage Albarino. And this one, somebody said they had a polka dot bottle with a polka dot glass. You are drinking. Yep, there we are. That's the Paco y Lola as well. And this one here, interestingly enough, this is another 100% Albarino from the Salmez Valley. And they use free run juice from their oldest vineyards. Now, this one, they aged on the fine lees for a year with a weekly batonnage, which I think is really interesting. And then it sits in a stainless steel tank for another 4 years before it's bottled. And here, even with that, I mean, I definitely get a difference in the texture between the Gran Bassan and the Paco y Lola. But it's not heavy. It does have a little bit more of an oily texture to it. There, it's a little more herbal, a little more spicy, but it still carries through some of those fresh notes and some citrus and whatnot. So really absolutely fascinating, you know, range of wines that we got a chance to try. Real quick, we're going to jump into tasting here, but a shameless plug for hashtag Riaspicious Wines, and then for the Instagram at Riaspicious Wines and at Gregory Vine. And so I'm going to stop sharing, and I'm going to get a chance to see everybody now. Oh, that's so much better. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
All right, so let's go ahead and just do a little kind of fun little round robin, little tasting. My question first. Okay, yeah, Steph, go ahead.
Yeah, I saw this like appear in the chat a couple times. Why the Riesling type bottle? You see the Pfeffignanis, it's more of the Riesling style, and we also have the Grand Bazan.
The Grand Bazan.
And then there's also Mar de Frades that has more of that Riesling bottle. I heard this from the Mar de Frades team, but I think it changes depending on the producer. Maybe it's also just stylistic. But the Mar de Frades team, the woman there, the winemaker, there's a woman, and she chose to have a Riesling type bottle, and it's this beautiful bright blue bottle if you ever see it. So the winemaker, she decided to have a Riesling style bottle because she thought it'd be easier for, she was thinking about the female consumer, which we tend to have smaller hands, especially if you're like Kat and I who are like below 5 feet. So it makes it easier to hold. Yeah, I'm not sure about Grand Bazan or Pfeffignanis.
I think some of the wines that are aged tend to be more in the Burgundy style mm-hmm. bottle. Yeah. And I don't know. I think, Steph, you're probably right where it is, probably a little bit more stylistic. I mean, I think these are really cool bottles, and I think they work really well for, I mean, think of, you know, Alsatian wines that tend to be drunk young. maybe it's almost a way to say, hey, drink this one now and hold on to this one, you know? I don't know.
They're terrible for wine soup cases. They're terrible for your refrigerator. They don't fit anything.
The wine itself is good, right, Jeff?
Yeah.
Right, but that's the whole point, Jeff.
That's really how you feel, Jeff.
Right. But that's the point, Jeff. They don't fit in your wine cellar. They don't fit anywhere, so you just have to drink it.
Drink them.
Anybody? I'm sorry, Kat, go ahead.
The old idea that the Abarino grape originated from the Rhine, and these Rhine-shaped bottles also are indicative of that. I know when we were at Grand Bazan, that question did arrive. The response was something that I cannot recreate because it is more foul than even my Jersey mouth will say. But it is now definitely more of
Yay,
a
Yay, Jersey! Woo!
Thank you, Lori. There is something.
I live there now, too, but I'm a New Yorker.
Woo! But, you know, it does definitely make a stand. So you look at the Miña Vida, and I'm sure you all have a bottle of some sort in your possession at this point. Why change the bottle shape? But looking at something that may have a grape in there that needs a little more of this, as opposed to a clean, crisp, pure Abarino, or something like Malone or Riesling, that just kind of can float and be proper and just kind of sit in a bottle like such. But the winemaker at Grand Bazan basically did say it was very much a marketing. It looked pretty, and people were more readily able to look at that and grab it because they were used to buying Riesling in that area.
It's interesting. Do people that look at that bottle and think sweetness, though, too? Sometimes, you know, with the Riesling?
That was something, like I said, we initiated the conversation. It did kind of get him fired up. So I don't know that he was that happy with the fact that people think that all wines are going to be sweet. But the comments and the questions were risen. But, you know, I mean, anytime you go on a trip and you start bringing up conversation about certain things like that, and traditions are as they are, you know, it kind of can go one way or the other. So,
and, you know, it'd be easy if they put the scale of sweetness on the back so people would know it would be dry.
Yeah, that's a good point,
I suppose. It's interesting, though, there's no real regional identity for bottle shape, because you get Burgundy bottles, you have Bordeaux bottles, and Martin Kodak comes in a Bordeaux bottle, I think, right? And the Grand Bazan, which I've had before, comes in something close to a Riesling bottle.
Yeah, I think their Bourgognes comes in a Bordeaux bottle. And yeah, I mean, you're right. And I think, unlike, you know, very few wines, you know, legislate the shape of the bottle, like Alsace.
Right.
I want to hear what you guys are drinking. So if you want to share what you're drinking, how about you raise your glass up and we'll just in case. All right, Debbie, go for it, girl.
I'm first. All right. So I had to take my little ice pack off. My little ice pack was on it. I've got the Paco Loco 2018. And I love this wine. This, you know, I've had Albarinos from other areas of Rio Spacious, and this one, I think, has just got such a great expression of where it comes from, with the bright acidity and the minerality. And the minute I opened it, I just smelt the ocean. And it's becoming one of my favorite Albarinos. It's just, I think, in the course of Albarinos from the different regions, I think I'm more favorable to the ones that are oceanside than the ones that are more inland, because there definitely is a terroir difference.
Absolutely.
In that, and what that particular wine expresses.
Awesome. Thanks for sharing.
Yep.
Who's next?
Okay, I'll go.
All right, Brianne.
Yep.
Hi there. I'm drinking the Serra da Estrela Albarino. It is from the subzone of O Rosal. It's totally, typically, classically Albarino. I love it. It's fresh, crisp, refreshing, and I'm a huge Albarino fan. I always offer it as, if you like Sauv Blanc, try this kind of thing, because Sauv Blanc, love Sauv Blanc. It doesn't need any help right now selling. Like, you know, great for them, but I'm all about, you know, kind of helping the smaller regions or lesser known grapes get some sales, and like for the same price as, you know, this is a $16 retail according to that I have here, and you know there are some big Sauv Blanc brands at that price point, and so I'm very happy to suggest that as an alternative.
Awesome, thanks for sharing, Jeffrey. I know you. I think you had your glass up. You're next.
Yeah, interesting. So we are definitely acid hounds in our house, and my wife is a big Sauvignon Blanc fan and a big Albarino fan, kind of as this is great. This one is the Nora de Nave. I'm terrible with Spanish pronunciations. This was fermented and aged in French oak barrels, so it's quite different from what I'm used to for Albarino. 5 months on the lees as well. I'm in the sparkling unit for diploma right now. I'm just reading about that. The reason I was asking about that, you know, when you spend enough time on the lees, you get the biscuit, right? Before that, there's the kind of other lees kinds of things. But this one really does show the oak quite a bit. So
what's the vintage on that?
2015.
15, okay.
Yeah, so kind of both. You know, you get the leesy element and definitely the oak shows. So I'd have to say it would be something that I would like, got to watch out for that, because at least my wife is not a big oak fan, you know, in especially in whites. And so you got to be careful with those.
Yeah, definitely.
Very nicely done.
More of a food wine, though, than just a porch pounder.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool. Anybody else?
I'll go.
Okay. Thanks, Lori.
So I have the, and I'm going to mess up the name also, but Albarino de
Feffignanis.
And this is a new producer for me. So I did a little look, you know, research on them a little bit. And the person who designed the label designs jets. So that, I don't know exactly how you go from designing a jet and jewelry to a wine label, but I think that's awesome. But this is a brilliant wine. It is crisp. It is acidic. When you get it on your palate, on your tongue, you just salivate over and over again. Very, very citrus, very, you know, lemon, lime, the stone fruit is there. And the salinity isn't there at the beginning and then creeps up and there it is. And I mean, I love salinity. I love acidity in the wine, a huge acid head. But it's really interesting how the salinity isn't there at the beginning and then just powers through to carry on to the finish that just keeps going and going and going.
That's fun. I love that. Fepinianis was one of my very first Albarinos that I ever had. And they're, I mean, have always been one of my favorite go-tos. I love it. Nice. Love them. All right. Who's next? And if, Court, I was going to call on you anyways.
Well, I'm tasting the same wine as you did, but it's one of my favorites. I'm doing the Gran Bazan Etiqueta Ambar, which I've only ever had the Etiqueta Verde before, which is one of my favorites. I always buy it, so I was excited to get to try this. And I think the additional lees aging does add a little bit of complexity to it, but I love the texture of this wine. I mean, it's from the Salinas Valley, so it's right on the sea there, and you really get that, like, feeling of sea spray, which I appreciate. And as a person who, Albarino was the first wine I ever really learned about, like before Sauvignon Blanc, before Pinot Grigio, anything. It's a very classic and nostalgic example, I think.
That's awesome. Thanks, Court. All right. Who's next? If I don't get a volunteer, I'm calling. And because Emma's, okay, great, Randy, go ahead.
I've got the Terrascada. Get that up there for you. It's really nice. It's really complex. And one of the things about Albarino that I'm not gravitated usually toward Albarino because a lot of them are pretty simple and flowery. And this one is more fruity. It brings the fruit right up front, a lot of lemon, orange peel, but it's also got like a lanolin kind of a thing, some apricot in there. So it's pretty complex. And there's a really nice salinity that goes along with the acidity, which is also superb. It's an awesome wine. 3 months on the lee since we were talking about that. Oh, and it's Ouro Sal.
Yeah. What's the vintage on that, Randy?
2018.
Okay.
And Trish, I'm going to jump in. Just so this is a blend, of course. So it's got the Caña, yes, Blanco and the Lodero, oh, as right, well. And being from Ouro Sal, it's a little riper, so... Yeah, I get that. It's just a bigger wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it can, exactly, really hold up to sort of more oily fishes, maybe even the chicken. So
I had earlier today with asparagus, roasted asparagus. It was nice, yeah, with that.
Just speaking of food, I noticed Courtney was talking about persimmons. So you really like persimmons? Really?
You're on mute. You're
I can't
on mute,
hear you, Courtney. But she loves
I know,
it.
I could tell. She was definitively in love.
Okay, so people have said, I've heard people say, like, once you eat one, you, like, can't stop. Well, I haven't brought myself to eat one yet.
Oh, no, you should. So what are persimmons?
Oh, the best. They're so good.
Oh, they're really, really pretty.
They are sparkles, which sounds really gross, and they look really weird. But they taste like very much like the sea to me. Like almost if you like raw oysters, you might like persimmons.
Not persimmons, persimmons.
Yes.
Very different.
Wait, I replied a cat. Why did I reply to cat? I meant to put it on the chat.
All right, here are the persimmons, guys.
Yay!
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Aren't those, those look delicious? Don't you just want to pop one of those in your mouth?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I will say, though, I mean, these are one of the hardest types of seafood for them to actually harvest because they grow on the rocks. And, these guys get all bundled up, and the waves come crashing in when they're trying to pull them off the rock. I was watching, I don't know if any of you guys have seen the Jose Andres Made in Spain. He did two series of videos. And if you haven't, they're absolutely phenomenal. He's hilarious to watch. And he goes out one day and he harvests the persimmons with these guys. And I tried them like 20 years ago, and I didn't care for it, but I would try it again.
Are they just shellfish?
You never know.
Have you tried them?
in that long?
What's that?
You haven't tried them in that long?
No, it's I haven't had much of an occasion. When we were in Rio Spices, we were eating all this amazing, you know,
pill.
But we, I mean, the thing is there's just so much great, there are so many great seafoods that I know that I really like and devour that, you know, because percevus weren't on the platter, I wasn't going to go out of my way. All right, let's do one last one.
When we make our pilgrimage, we'll all try them.
There we go. When we get to come into the Santiago court.
Yeah, you got to walk the whole, and then you can reward yourself with some percevus.
I'll reward myself with a lot more than that.
Christy, do you have a little Albarino drinker there? You're on mute.
He's
had it. That's awesome.
I think my husband's going to be the Albarino drinker tonight. He's going to... You get the rest of the bottle.
I think a lot of us are drinking a little bit more frequently and enjoying some really nice stuff these days. And I mean, it's one of the positive things of what we're going through. So,
yeah. So I know we're at the 6:30 mark. So if you have to go, we understand. If you still have some questions that haven't been answered, please go ahead.
This is great.
Guys, thank you so much.
I don't want the interaction to end. My husband, who I've been hanging out with for the past 3 weeks.
How many people have been to Rio Spices? All right. How many people want to go to Rio?
Oh, yeah.
Now? Can we go now?
All right. Be on this chat.
You know, that actually brings up a really good point. So I would be on the plane with you guys the first, you know, landing foot in Rio Spices in the flash if I could. But one of the things that the DO did want us to convey to you guys, because there's still, I mean, there's a lot of question, you know, with the corona and what's going on and everybody's at home, what's happening. And the reality is that, you know, the agricultural industry is one of those industries that is still moving forward.
Sure.
I know it's true in California here. I mean, you know, tasting rooms are closed and you can't go visit tasting rooms, but the vines are being tended to, the production's happening in the facilities. And all I can see is that once we get through this mess that we're all in, that we are going to enjoy some absolutely spectacular 2019 and soon to be 2020 wines. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, it's been really fun to have everybody on here. And I think it's a blast to, you know, it's funny how these circumstances have forced us to do something like this, but I think that this is going to be a fairly, you know, a little bit more common type of a thing for people.
So, I kind of like this. I really do. It's informative and, you know, okay, yeah, we just see pictures and we can't, like, hug and sit there and taste together, but...
But you don't have to call an Uber to go home either, so...
That is true.
Whenever I go to take...
You can drink the whole bottle.
I'm 2.5 hours. Yeah, so I'm really happy about that. And I don't have to spit.
Very true.
What's spitting?
So can I go back and just ask, like, a technical question? I just was curious, how high are those pergolas? Because I'm thinking as... a winemaker, you know, who's in the vineyard, like, if I'm doing this all the time to harvest, I'm dying. Like,
look at those muscles you'll get me getting, Lori.
They typically sit about 5 to 7 feet above the ground.
Okay.
And so, I mean, we went, yeah, so, I mean, it's still, I mean, this is, it, think about it, though. Think about how backbreaking work, you know, harvesting is anyways. And think about when you're either bent, you know, hunched over harvesting off of a bush vine, or your hands are up here and you're clipping. But it's actually not as bad, because when we were in Rio Spices, one of the very first stop that we did, they kind of let us do that. And so they stand on crates. Now, you know, Kat, I think we put her on our shoulders, but they stand on crates and you're really close to the canopy. So you're really kind of like this. It's not more like this. So, okay. You know, there's a lot, and then you've got they hang a bucket on the wires that are under the pergola system, and they just clip them into, you know, put them into the bucket. So it is painful work. That's why hand harvesting. And I think that what's amazing is when you can get wines like this for 20, you know, $15, $18, $20, $25 that, and with the amount of labor that goes into it.
It's surprising.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Rick's speaking from experience. He did it for about 5 minutes. And you should have seen him whining. Oh, my God, this is so hard.
It's 4 minutes longer than Trish was doing it. So Trish is too busy eating grapes off the vine. So,
harvesting is never pleasant. Like, let's be honest.
Well, that is that. That's true. It's a little tough. It's a little cold at, you know, 3 a.m. But the, I guess the positive also is that the fruit is hanging lower. So they're, it's easier for, they can probably harvest faster because they don't have to deal with the leaves that are in and that. So,
yeah. And they do, I mean, they do, you know, clip during the growing season. They
green
do
drop
clip back, you know, green the, drop. You know, the leaves. And I mean, to Kat's point earlier, one of the biggest things is that even though the fruit is hanging, it's getting a lot of air circulation, so it's not getting the potential effects of mildew from that really rainy, cold, damp.
Do they have a lot of disease pressure?
They can because it's so cold and wet. I mean, powdery mildew and downy mildew are always problems. And even like to Kat's point, she talked about botrytis a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.
Cheers.
All very much.
Empty.
Yeah. Get healthy, everybody.
I have to go put some Gamay in this now.
Drink healthy. Drink hearty and often. Okay. Bye, guys.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. Until next week, Sláinte.